Welcome to The Mental Breakdown, where we tackle all issues related to mental health, mental illness, parenting, schooling, relationships, and everything in between. While Drs. Bernie and Richard will provide the most up-to-date ideas and perspectives, the information provided in this podcast is not a substitute for medical care. Our goal here at The Mental Breakdown is to provide you with information to help you make your life the best it can be. So without further ado, here's Dr. Bernie and Dr. Richard.
Okay. So, all right. So we just recorded episode 29 of The Mental Breakdown. And as we were processing the audio, we realized that there was an echo throughout. And I think that what was happening is I was talking into my microphone and my voice was traveling over into your microphone and vice versa.
Right. So because we have a different table.
We kind of changed our room around a little bit.
Right. We rearranged the room for feng shui, and the table that we're using now is narrower and our microphones were closer to each other.
Yes.
So unbeknownst to us.
Right.
Each of our microphones was picking up both of us.
Right. Okay. So you know what? You figure these things out as you go.
Well, you figure them out. I just get frustrated.
Well, and hopefully it sounds okay now because we have this very high-tech remedy that we did, which is just basically a portfolio in between the microphones to block the sound.
We went into Bernie's machine shop and fabricated a barrier that should
hopefully
take care of the sound transmitting across the table.
Hope so. So, you know what? It's a learning process. We're figuring out some things about the reverberation. You know, this mm-hmm. is a little operation that we're doing out of a small room in our office. We don't have any of the technical support that a lot of other podcasts have and everything. So we're figuring it out as we go.
And we refer to it as our podcast room.
That's right.
But there are some changes because there is a little reverberation in here because we have to deaden some of the reverberation.
Right.
So
right.
It's a step in the right direction.
The other thing about episode 29 is that we talked right up to the point of the last second, and actually went over about 3 seconds from what Mixlr usually allows us to go over. So we didn't get a chance to remind you to go to Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, everywhere. You can find us everywhere and follow us. We really hope that you will go on to iTunes and write a review because that's how other people get to know that we're there. We really have some big ideas, especially related to the topic of discussion for episode 29, which is the opt-out movement. We really hope to continue with that movement, and we're planning to get some guests in. But of course, the first question that we often get from guests is, "How many listeners do you have?" And so, the way we know how many listeners we have is if you write a review or do a rating on iTunes, so that we know that you're out there. It doesn't have to be anything significant; just doing something to let us know that you're listening, so that we can say that we have more than 3 listeners,
right.
Because that's how many reviews that we have right now. So please take a moment and go on to iTunes and write a brief review, or like I said, in the very least, just rate us so that we know that you're out there.
Let us know that you're out there, right.
On our practice website at pacflorida.com, we just recently updated and put some information out there about the workshop that we have coming next month, November 13th. We're going to be doing a workshop on medication myths and misperceptions. I'm really looking forward to that workshop. I like talking about medications and the risks and benefits of medications.
Right.
And a lot of people wonder about that stuff. We will be offering CEUs for licensed mental health counselors, licensed clinical social workers, and marriage and family therapists. Also coming next month on November 10th, we're doing a free mental health screening. People will be able to stop by for, a 10 or 15 minute visit with one of us. And we're going to run through a mental health screener with you, see if there's anything going on and anything that we can do to help out with any problems that you may be experiencing and get you set up with some support if that's what's needed.
Yep. So looking forward to that.
Yeah, a lot of things.
That's a nice community service.
Yeah, a lot of things coming up in the next couple of months. So, again, please bear with us for this for some of the audio throughout episode 29. It's very frustrating that it happened because it was great information. We think it's great information because that's why we said it. But it's a great topic.
I think it is a great topic because this could become a constitutional question because, you know, the minority leader of the Florida legislature has supported parents who have decided to opt out. So this could easily become a question for constitutional scholars to sort out.
Right.
So it does have some important implications.
He is one that we've reached out to see if we can get him on the podcast.
Right. We'd love to interview him.
And so hopefully we'll be able to get him on. But again, it's going to, you know, one of the questions that will be asked is how many listeners do we have? Is it,
is it worth his time?
Right. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, and we know that by your writing reviews and, rating us on iTunes. That's how we will find that out. So, all right. Well, that's our brief intro, our brief apology for poor audio quality. We'll have to get our audio technician on that to
well, the problem's been solved, though.
We hope so.
Stay tuned for number 30 this time next week.
Yeah, that's so exciting that we're on number 30.
Up to 30 already.
Mm-hmm. All right. So, enjoy the podcast and, contact us if you have any questions or any of your own comments and thoughts.
Right. Love to know your thoughts about this opt-out movement and standardized testing in general. So we would love to hear from you on those topics.
Yes. All right. Thank you. Welcome to episode 29 of The Mental Breakdown. I'm Dr. Bernie. And Richard, we have a very exciting topic today. We've been talking about this all week, and we've kind of been hinting at some of these things over the past few months, really. And so today we are going to sort of, I think you said last week, I think you used the phrase, a full frontal assault. And today will be the day that we storm the beaches.
Well, it is. It's a full frontal assault, but it's also our first foray into this very important and contentious topic. And we hope our listeners tune in and let us know what they think, because this is a topic of some consequence. You'll be hearing more about it, and we're really, really interested in your opinions about the topic.
Yes. So let's get right into it, because we have a lot to talk about in a little bit of time that we have, and hopefully some folks will log in and listen to us on Mixlr and join in the conversation, because I think that this is an important one, and one that is going to be really important that everybody gets involved with.
This is a topic of interest to everybody with children of school age.
Yes.
So tune in and join us.
I think that the first place we need to begin is with the recognition that we've talked about before, that our school system really isn't living up to the promise that we've made. I was listening to another podcast this week, and it was an interview actually with President Obama interviewing an author that he's a big fan of, and they were talking about all kinds of things. But one of the things that they said was the author was talking about how she feels as though it's easier for us to say things that aren't true than things that are true. And it was confusing when she was first talking about it. But what it came down to, and the example, surprisingly, the example that she used was the education system. And she said that it's very easy for us all to talk badly, negatively, about the school system. When in her experience, her communications with folks, she feels that the education system is doing a wonderful job. She feels that everybody in the education system is happy. And she says whenever she hears negative things about the education system, her first question is, have you talked to anybody in the education system? Have you talked to anybody to see what's going on? The puzzled look on your face is the exact puzzle puzzled look I had.
When did she say this?
This was last week.
When did she say this?
The podcast was released last week. I'm not sure exactly when the
podcast was released.
Where did, I don't know. Iowa. Iowa. So when I heard that, and you know, you and I have had our discussions about the federal government's education reform approach, and we're not completely satisfied with that either. I think that part of what she's saying is right, and that is that we're talking about this, which is great, and people are being critical, which I think is great. Now, that's about the extent to which I agree with her, because anything further than that, any teacher that I've talked to agrees that what's happening right now in the school system is problematic. And the reason that I say that, and the reason that we're taking this pretty firm stand, is because when we think about the education system, we have made certain promises. Here in the state of Florida, for example, we have this movement of college and career preparedness, that when students graduate in high school, they are going to be ready for either college or career.
In fact, that's the name of the bill.
Right.
In fact, that's the name of the bill, every student ready for college or career, the name of the bill that went through the legislature.
And the issue is, is that that's not happening.
Correct.
You know, a large percentage, up to 50% or more of college freshmen are not prepared for college. Of the 50 to 60%, and by some estimations even more, of high school graduates or high school students that will never go to college, they leave high school without any particular trade, any particular skill. So we're creating these policies that are very grandiose, that are very...
Well, they are, and the bill you're talking about replaces No Child Left Behind. And No Child Left Behind was aspirational. The aspiration was that by 2014, all children would be proficient. Okay, it's now 2015. That was an aspirational bill. This new bill is also an aspirational bill that all children will be ready for college or career by the time they graduate from high school. That's what you mean with happening. That's what you mean by a broken promise. We're not living up to our
promise. And I think that it's great that we have these aspirational goals. However, the issue the recognition that we need, the awareness that we need, is that while we have those aspirational goals, we are doing little, if not nothing, to accomplish those goals or to work towards those goals.
That's the rub, that if you have that kind of goal, that's good. The goal is good, but then you have to put policies into place which help to ensure that you achieve that goal. That's what's missing
right now,
are the policies that make that happen. It didn't happen with No Child Left Behind.
Right.
No Child Left Behind was underfunded. So the goals, the policies and procedures needed to reach those goals couldn't be achieved because it was inadequately funded.
And I think to be fair, I think that the current movement, all children prepared for college and career, I think that it is a movement in the right direction from where No Child Left Behind was. I mean, No Child Left Behind was almost, and I'm going to be a little bit critical, or a lot critical, was almost delusional. I mean, to say that all students will read on grade level by third grade is not realistic.
To make that statement indicates that you don't understand children, and you don't understand the reading process,
and you don't understand statistics.
Period. It is not It's not going to happen. Not everybody's going to be reading proficiently by third grade.
Right. And so that one, you know, again, great aspiration, great goal, but not realistic. Now to say all students by the time they graduate high school will be prepared for either college or a career, that's a movement in the right direction.
depending on how you
define career. I mean, you know, even people who have severe intellectual limitations, you know, we can prepare them for some form of career, but they're not going to go to the traditional high school to get that preparation. And again, the issue here is that we're making these policies, we're creating these goals, but we're not formulating the infrastructure to support that in a way that is realistic for most students.
And I think that's the critical point here, is that the goal is okay. There's nothing wrong with having high expectations and setting high goals. The problem is that you are obligated to have policies and procedures that will accomplish those goals. That's where I'm taking the policymakers to task, is that they're not putting policies and procedures in place that will result in achieving those goals.
So what this has done is a lot of these aspirational goals have resulted in supporting this movement for testing. Man, we're doing a lot of testing. We just found out this week that there's even more and more testing coming about. We're not just talking about end-of-year exams. We're not just talking about end-of-course exams. We're now talking about end-of-term exams, end-of-semester exams. And again, you know, I feel like we always qualify those statements with our statements with the fact that we're not against testing. We're not against making sure that students are gaining the skills that they need. But we're testing these kids to death. I mean, we're going to get into, in a little bit, I'm trying not to jump ahead. We're going to get into the real crux of the problem as it relates to these tests. But we're creating all these tests. We're doing assessment after assessment after assessment. And the data just does not support that it's doing anything positive for the students. The students are no more prepared for college than they were before we were using these tests. They are no more prepared for a career than they were before we did these tests. We're doing all of this work. We're putting all this stress, all of these limitations on what teachers can do because they're having to prepare students for these high-stakes tests. But it doesn't. It's not resulting in the outcome that we were promised.
That's right. And we're no longer, what you were talking about there is we're no longer just talking about the FCAT. There was a time when
here in Florida,
everybody's concern was the FCAT. Right. And whatever state you live in, there was a state test that public school students had to pass. Now we're talking about not only that test, but now we're talking about end of semester exams, end of course exams, and end of 9-week exams. So now we're talking about another set of three additional tests that are being used. And I guess I'm a little less charitable than you on this one. I always hear people say, well, no, we're not opposed to testing. You know, I'm not sure that I'm not opposed to it anymore. Because testing should serve some purpose. I'm not sure that they're serving the purpose that they're intended to serve. Politically, it sounds good that we're going to hold people accountable by testing students. That sounds wonderful. But translated into daily practice, that's not happening. And that's where we're taking issue with the policymakers, is that the tests are not doing what you say they're doing. And in fact, they're really doing a lot of harm.
So maybe we should jump in our outline here to get to that point. Because and we'll use that point as to get us where our ultimate goal is. And that is, well, if you know the title of this podcast is Opting to Opt Out, we're going to be talking a little bit about the opt-out movement here in just a little bit. But let's take the focus on the test for a moment. Richard, you and I, we've developed psychometric tests before. We have created tests that have been published, and one of the processes that we've learned, and not just that, we've taught test and measurements courses, we've taught assessment courses, and because of that, and having taught those classes at both the undergraduate and graduate level, and taken all those courses, of course, we understand the process that it takes to develop a good test. There are certain, you have to, for lack of a better phrase, you have to test the test. When you create a test on depression, for example, a test to assess depressive symptoms, you have to make sure that that test actually assesses depression. And so, and not something else. When we develop, we have to make a test. We have to make sure that the math test includes the content that we're interested in, that includes the all the procedures and all of the content that we want the test to measure, so that we are sure that the students have the skills, or the test takers have all of the skills that we're looking for.
Let me make that even simpler. If we have a math test that has complicated problems that somebody has to read, now testing reading.
Yeah, absolutely.
Not
so,
just math.
Okay. There's a lot that goes into, and you know, it. To some, it sounds like minutia, but those minutia are what you have to attend to when you're developing a test, if you want the test to be a good test. You don't want, like, just a quick example. There's a common test that we use, and one of the items on it says, "I often brood." True or false? A lot of people have no idea what the word brood means. And so when they don't understand what the word means, their response to that question may or may not be valid, because now we don't know if they're answering, do I often brood, like, do I brew tea, or do I brood where I sit around and I'm sullen and I'm sad and I just sit and think about things over and over again. We don't know how they're answering, and it's because they don't understand. So that test became, instead of a test about maybe depressive symptoms, it became a reading test. Right. And so these kinds of details are critical to create when it comes to creating a test. And what we do when we're developing a test, we look at two major psychometric properties, reliability and validity. All of you psychology students and undergraduate and graduate students out there are maybe having some PTSD symptoms from their test and measurement courses. But reliability and validity are critically important when it comes to a test.
There are rules that we have to follow.
Reliability, simply stated, is consistency. A test measures the same thing repeatedly. So it allows you to give a test on one day, and you know that the next time that person takes the test, it's going to be measuring the same concept. And that if you administer that test to person A, it measures the same construct as when you administer that test to person B. And when test administrator A administers that test, it measures the same concepts as when administrator B administers that test.
Whether you give the test or I give the test, we should get on the same person.
And that's reliability.
We should get the same result. Right. And if we don't, the test is not reliable. Okay. Or if you give the test at one point, at one time of the year, and then a second time,
it should
give you the same result.
And
of year shouldn't
the reason that reliability is so important is because we use it to assess change or progress. So anyone who's ever taken a course where the teacher gives you the final exam on the first day of class, and you fail it, of course. because you don't know the material because you haven't had the class yet. And then they give you the same final exam at the end of the course. Well, the idea is that we can measure change because what has happened is over the course of those 16 weeks, you've learned material. And the goal is that if that test was reliable, you should be able to see change over time, because if nothing had changed, if you had gained no information, your score should be the same the second time you took it as it was the first time you took it. And that's just called test retest reliability. And so reliability is very, but reliability does not measure or does not tell us whether a test actually measures what it's supposed to measure. And that is validity. Validity is the extent to which a test measures what it purports to measure. So if you create a test that looks at multiplication skills, you need to make sure that it actually assesses multiplication skills and not reading skills, using the example that we had just a moment ago. So we have to make sure the test is valid. Well, you do that by a very extensive, I mean, we learned this when we were developing our rating scale. That is a very extensive, time-consuming process. And it doesn't happen just because you have a test that has a whole bunch of multiplication problems on it doesn't mean that it's a valid test for multiplication. You have to look at the validity.
And you said you have to test the test. And you said you have to test the test. You have to test to make sure that a test is reliable and is valid. And that's a process that you have to undergo before you start using a test.
So when we are thinking about how this is going to work, what we tend to do is we tend to create our new test, and then we compare the results of the new test to older tests that we know are reliable and valid. And so we can compare those two, and if both tests give us the same results, then we know that the new test is, in fact, valid. Now, we went all over the place with that to give you a little bit of background about psychometric properties. How does that relate to what we're talking about? The majority of the tests that we use to assess students in school right now have no psychometric properties assessed. We do not know if they're reliable or valid.
And we're talking are you talking about tests like the FSA, or are you talking about the tests that we give at the end of the
term? I'm talking about what we learned, for example, here in Florida last year, is that, and what we learned about, I think, about these tests almost every year, is that what we're referring to as the results of these tests depend on what we want them to say. Each year, the state adjusts what it considers to be the pass line. Now, if you had good psychometric properties, you would know a score of X is required to be considered passing. But what the state is doing, because there aren't really these firm psychometric properties, is the state is saying, oh, well, this year, this score is needed to be passing. Well, last year enough students didn't pass it, so let's change it to this score this year. This is now the score that's needed to be considered passing. And that wishy-washy does not hold well when it comes to developing good tests, reliable tests, valid tests.
What we're talking about here, for those of you who don't have a background in this area, is that any test that's given should be evaluated. When a teacher is handed a test and said, here, give this to your student of the course at the end of the course, because it's not the teachers who are making these end-of-course exams. The end-of-course exams are made someplace else by somebody else, not by the child's teacher. And if those tests, if the reliability and validity of those tests have not been assured, then the results of those tests should be questioned.
Right.
But we're not allowed to question those results. Teachers are not allowed to question them. Parents are not allowed to question them. And if psychologists ask to see the data for reliability and validity, they're simply told, no, this is proprietary. So we have no way of determining, and this is an important point, none of us, professional psychologists, professional statisticians, teachers, parents, none of us have any way of judging the reliability and validity of these tests. We're told the tests are reliable and valid, but we're not allowed to independently document.
Exactly. So that is a tremendous concern that we have. And you know, the last time, over the last few years, some of the definitions of these things have changed. And, you know, when we were in graduate school, the definition of validity was, as we said before, that a test measures what it purports to measure. There's a newer definition, and I think it really holds true to exactly what we're talking about, and that is that validity is the extent to which conclusions about a test are valid, meaning that what decisions you make based upon the results of the test are consistent with the conclusions that you should be making. And that's where these tests fall apart. And again, it goes back to what we were talking about earlier, that students are no more ready for college now than they were before. They are no more prepared for a career than they were before. If that's the goal of the tests, to make sure that students have the skills that they need to be prepared for post-secondary education or post-secondary work entry, why aren't these tests better predicting that? And that's the crux of the problem.
Well, if students do poorly on the tests, the conclusion is that they're not ready.
But the first question, so everybody says, well, they're not ready, so it
has to be somebody's fault. So teachers get blamed, or parents get blamed. But the larger question, is, if students don't do well on the test,
Number one, is
the test measuring what it's supposed to measure? My daughter's in high school. When she sits down to take an end of course exam, I don't know anything about that test. I don't know whether it's testing that content or not. I don't know where the questions came from. I don't know how to prepare her for the exam. I don't know anything about it. But I can't assure that the test is testing what it says it's going to test. And the second thing is, if students are doing poorly, what are school districts doing about that? And that's the second problem that I have. What are we doing about children who are doing? It's not enough to know that kids are underperforming. What do you do when you find out that they are underperforming?
And so that, again, is not coming across in the testing. The testing is not telling us what comes next. What do we need to do? What should happen to better prepare these students or to make these students stronger students? And because it doesn't tell us that, we have to strongly question the validity of these tests. We have to say these tests are not doing what they're supposed to be doing. Because they're supposed to be doing this and they're not doing that, these tests are not valid. And if they're not valid, I'm going to use strong words here that you'll like.
Okay.
Is it really ethical that we're using them?
Okay.
I like the word ethical because my daughter doesn't have to take three tests to tell me if she knows algebra or not.
Okay, she's going to take three or four tests that test her algebra skills, but we don't need three or four tests. A good teacher can tell me in 5 minutes whether my daughter knows the information or not.
Right.
She doesn't need to take three tests.
And you know, that's sad that things have developed the way that they have because, you know, from teachers that we've talked to, a lot of this is taken out of the teacher's hands. Teachers don't create their own tests anymore.
All of it is taken out of the teachers.
These tests are created by outside groups,
right.
Outside companies, outside agencies who develop these tests, not using the curriculum that the teachers use in the classroom every day, not using the same system of measurements that the teacher uses every day. And so it's...
And it may not even test what the teacher taught.
Right.
And it may not even
right.
test what
Absolutely.
The teacher taught.
You know, I had an example right. from a math, from a science teacher, and they were saying that, you know, when they follow the curriculum, they have certain things that they go through in a sequential order. There are things that are going to be on the end of course exam that they will not get to until after the end of course exam is administered. And if they get to it in time, and if the right. test was at least created based upon the curriculum that they're learning from, then at least it would be sequential. At least they would know, oh, they won't mm-hmm. be able to get to that information by the time they have to take the test. It's unfortunate.
But that's not factored in.
Right. But that's not factored in. That's not factored into the decision-making process.
So we just got a... you know, we just got a comment on Mixler from Miss Cassie, and she's a former teacher. She said it's so frustrating not being able to see the results of the test. And that's a great point, that teachers don't even see the test or the test results. They're left with students who, you know, consequences are being laid down to these students, these teachers' students, you know, and we talk to a lot of teachers, you know, teachers love their students. You know, they feel very connected to their students. I mean, they spend a lot of time with them, and they want the best for them. But yet, the teachers, what happens to the student is completely out of the teacher's hands. They have no control over what happens to those students.
They know the score. They know what score the student got.
They know the score. They know what score the student got
later
on the test. Whether
after
they passed
decisions
it or not.
Have already been made. And sometimes it's too late then. You know, the teacher can't do anything about it. So what has all of this led to? And this really gets to the topic today. And that is the opt-out movement. And you and I, we've been working and following the opt-out movement, and it's progressing all over the country. And here in the state of Florida, some really interesting things are coming up about it that we're going to talk about. But the opt-out movement is a movement wherein parents and teachers, independently oftentimes, are encouraging students or making it where students are not taking these tests.
To opt out of standardized, of high stakes standardized testing. For those of you who haven't heard of the opt-out movement, it's opting out of these high stakes standardized tests.
Right.
So that we're talking
what
about
that means is that these students, you know, on days when these standardized tests are being administered, these students either stay home. Or they just, you know, they go to school, but they just don't take the tests. And we've seen this in all grade levels and, again, all across the United States. In fact, there was a big article at the end of last school year where a large percentage of several school districts, a lot of high schoolers, just opted out and did not take it. More students did not take the test than took the tests. And that's a growing trend. And again, we've been following that trend, and you know, we want to talk a little bit about what that means for those of us here in Florida. Different states will be different. You know, it's very different to opt out in New York than it is to opt out in Florida.
Our interest in the opt-out movement, we began to see these rumblings earlier on. Every professional organization, the American Psychological Association, the National Association of School Psychologists, the American Educational Research Association, all of those organizations have all come out squarely against high stakes standardized testing as it's currently being conducted. Okay, so teachers don't like it. Superintendents, the National Association of Superintendents, have been opposed to it. Teachers are opposed to it. Parents are opposed. Everybody's opposed to it, but the tests keep coming.
Okay.
Because of that, because educational policymakers at the federal, and I'm talking about Arne Duncan and Barack Obama here, who want testing, they're big advocates of testing, down to the state level, education departments are for testing, and it has made its way into state law in Florida. In other words, it's mandated by law that every public school student will take these tests.
Nobody's listening to the professionals.
So what's happened is parents have had to take the initiative. Teachers and parents have had to take the initiative to have this movement of what is civil disobedience. That seems to be the only alternative. You won't listen to the professionals who know how to do this. So the only alternative is for people to start these grassroots movements like opt out and say, we're not going to do that. Now, parents and children can do that. If teachers opt out, they're risking their certification. Pam Stewart, who's the Secretary of Education, said that in a letter to the state legislature, that they are jeopardizing their certification if they say, no, I'm not going to participate in this testing. So they can really be punished. We don't know what would happen to parents and students who don't take the test. I'm not sure. But is it, this might end up becoming a constitutional, do you have
If we think about this, maybe expand it a little bit, thinking about it more globally, you know, we have these expectations on high school students. Let's just talk about graduation. Let's forget about the poor things, the horrible things that we're doing to the 8-year-olds in third grade that are stressed out because if they don't pass this test, they won't get to go to fourth grade. But let's just think about high school for a minute. The concern is that what has happened here in Florida specifically is that some of these tests have been directly tied to graduation. So what that means is not only do you have to take algebra and pass algebra to graduate, you have to take and pass the end of course exam, the high stakes exam for algebra. Same thing for biology.
Right.
Same thing for world history. You have to take those end-of-course exams to be able to graduate. So we don't know yet what happens to students who opt out and choose not to take those tests. I think we're going to find out this year because we know of a lot of people who are really working on that in that movement and making decisions to opt out and making decisions not to allow their kids to participate in those tests.
Right, because if you opt out and don't take the test, does that mean you failed the test?
Right.
And does that mean you don't pass the course?
Right.
If you don't pass the course, you don't get a high school diploma. So we're talking about jeopardizing high school graduation by not taking
I think it's just algebra one that you have to pass, but the others you have to at least take it. Well, so if you don't take it, what does that mean?
Or
the world history exam or the biology exam.
For all the required end of course exams.
It's unbelievable that we're creating this situation where, you know, where there is no opting out, potentially, no chance to opt out, or that if you do opt out, you're risking graduation. Now, you may be asking, why is that so bad? Well, if you decided, if you had the money to put your child in a private school, they will get a recognized, valid high school diploma and never have to take one of those tests. So, and we know, because we work with students that go to all these different schools, we know that students who go to some of these private schools, go to the same colleges, sometimes better colleges, than students in regular public schools. So, and they've never taken these tests. So,
and they've never
why,
taken these tests.
Again, it goes back to the validity stuff. Why do we believe that these tests are somehow indicative of better preparation and better outcome for students, you know, in regular public schools?
And why are we only demanding that public... Here's the other question that bothers me. Why are we demanding that only public school students take these tests? A diploma is granted by a state.
Right.
No matter what school you go to, a diploma is granted by a state. Whether you go to a private school or a public school, the state gives you your diploma. Why is the state saying that only public school students have to take these tests and run the risk of not a grade or of getting a lower grade? Why aren't they mandated of all students who get a diploma?
And again, if we're going to work from the idea that, well, when we give these tests, we're making sure that they're meeting certain expectations, what shouldn't everybody have to meet those expectations? Why is it that Mr. Duncan, Arnie Duncan, why is it that his kids go to schools that don't require these state-mandated and federally mandated tests?
Let me complete the painting here. Arnie Duncan is the Secretary of Education, federal. But too late. He waited around too long at the ball. Arnie Duncan is the Secretary of Education, has been for both Obama administrations. He has demanded throughout the administration, these 8 years, he has demanded high-stakes testing in every state as the Secretary of Education. It's interesting that his children go to private school and they don't have to participate in these tests. So, I won't make any further comment about that, but I think it's clear what we're talking about here is that his own children don't have to do his policies.
It's, you know, again, when you step back and you look at what's happening, what the, you know, I hate to say the government, but it's really just policies, what these policies are doing and requiring and expecting. It really doesn't make any intuitive sense. It doesn't make sense that you can require this and potentially risk students' graduation at, you know, the schools where you go to for free, the schools that are that the government designed, that the states developed to provide a free and appropriate education for all students. Those schools require these things, whereas other schools that, you know, again, if you can afford to send your kid to some of these private schools, they can go and they don't have to take any of these and they get just as good of an education. Either it's because we're completely paranoid that regular high school, public high school teachers are ineffective, or there's some other motive, there's some other mission, and, you know, we can get into conspiratorial theories about the concern that we're trying to privatize education and all that kind of stuff, turn education into a business as opposed to what it's supposed to be.
You can't get that question answered either. Why are we giving these tests? Because nobody wants to continue this policy. Nobody in education wants to continue high-stakes standardized testing, whether it's at the end of year with a state-mandated test, or it's an end-of-course exam, or it's a semester exam, or it's an end-of-term exam. Nobody I have spoken to wants to test the way we're currently testing. And yet it not only continues to happen, in fact, it's increasing. We are increasing the number of tests that we're giving children. It's gotten to a point where teachers don't even make their own tests anymore because there are already too many tests being administered. So I can't ask my daughter's teacher how she's doing on her test.
Right.
I have to ask how she's doing on these standardized tests.
A few moments ago, Miss Cassie, who again was a former teacher, you know, she said that the stress that she witnessed you know, she described it as intense and heartbreaking. And I see that with my patients. You know, when I talk to my patients and, you know, again, if we think about, it feels like so much to talk about, but if we think about the way that this has evolved, you know, homework is rarely counted for points anymore. In one part, that's good. But in another part, what that means is your entire grade now falls based upon your performance on these tests. And you may feel like we're exaggerating, but, you know, just as a basic example, you know, here in Florida, here in Polk County, the county that we live in and we're broadcasting from, this year, all high school students are going to either take an end of course exam, which is the state mandated test, or they're going to take an end of year exam, which is through our district. Whether you're taking PE or you're taking chemistry, you're going to take an end of course exam that's created not by the teachers, but by a group of people hired by the district to create these tests. Now, the tests are not created based upon their curriculum. It's not based upon what they learned in class. It's based upon what these teachers developed based upon the material that they had. Now, again, that may be fine, but where the real problem comes is that that test happens at the end of the year and counts for 30% of their grade. 30%. So, feasibly, you could work hard in the year with all of your grades and everything with an A, but end up with a B or even a C as your final grade because of that one test. Who thinks that that's appropriate? I want to know who thinks that's appropriate.
Let me make it even more stark. My daughter goes to, let's say my child goes to a public school. She takes the end of course exam. She's been getting an A in the course, doesn't do well on the end of course exam for whatever reason, and gets a C. Her girlfriend goes to a private school, gets an A in the course, doesn't have to take the end of course exam, and gets an A on her transcript. When those two transcripts go to universities, nobody's going to ask who took the end of course exam. They're going to look at my daughter's C and her girlfriend's A and say, this is a better student.
Right. On paper, which may or may not be true. We are making, what this testing and this type of approach does is makes our students, again, less prepared, less attractive, less qualified on paper for post-secondary education.
So the goal is prepared for college and career, when in fact it could become an obstacle to both, and
nothing
that has nothing to do with the student. A student can be getting can have complete mastery of a course and not do well in the end of course exam and get a low grade.
If they go to public school, if they go to the private school, then there would be no consequences to that.
And that's what Arne Duncan and the others are doing. Their kids don't have to. Their children are not subjected to these policies.
Right.
They have forced.
And so the consequences are relatively dire. Right. And you know, we've talked to teachers. We've talked to students who say, who have, for lack of a better word, have just given up. They have given in to the fact that, look, I'm not going to pass this test. Why am I going to work? Why am I going? And you know, certainly that's you know, psychological, and certainly that's something that we work on with our patients to try to help them overcome some of those sort of external locus of control types of ideas and those you know, learned helplessness types of things that you know, from positive psychology and all. We work with our patients on that, but to some extent their beliefs are valid. You know, why should they? What's going to come about? You know, if they work as hard as they can all year long, scrape by with a B, which is still above average,
Not a bad grade.
You know, if you have an A, you could end up with a C. If you have a B, you could end up with a D.
You could end up with a D in the course, even though you were working at an above average level all semester. You take the end of course exam and don't do well for whatever reason. You could end up with a D.
You have a bad day,
and nobody's going to ask why. Colleges and employers are not going to ask why you got a D.
I mean, if you think about the high stakes testing that's always been around, like the SAT, the ACT, you can take those multiple times.
Right.
You know, it's not just one score that, and in fact, you know, I think they're changing this, but you can even say, oh, well, you scored best on reading this time you took it, and you scored math this best on math this time you took it, and we'll take the best scores. And I think they're changing that, unfortunately. But, you know, that's the way that high-stakes testing used to be. Now, you have these 1 or 2 days that you're going to take these tests, and that's it. You know, your score is your score. Whether you threw up on the test or you were absent, that's it.
Or you had a fever, or you had, doesn't matter, or you were having a bad day, or you, you know, something else bad happened that may have affected the results. That's not factored into this.
You know, of course not legally speaking, but it's emotionally, it's criminal. I mean, it's what we're doing is really... you know, horrific. I think that it's damaging to students. It's damaging to teachers. You know, when you think about, you know, teachers are being evaluated, and this goes back to the validity stuff. We're making decisions that affect people based upon these tests for things that the tests weren't designed to measure. If a test is designed to measure how well a student knows multiplication tables, not the same thing as saying that the test measures how well the teacher taught multiplication tables.
And here's another thing that we want people to know, and we want to start talking about this. Teachers are being evaluated on the results of student performance on these tests. If I'm a teacher, but I'm not allowed to know what's on the test. I don't know what's on the test.
Right.
I don't teach to that test.
And I can't do anything about it.
And I can't do anything about it, but I'm going to be evaluated. Let's say my students decide to just say, I don't care. They call it Christmas tree, the test, okay? They decide not to do well on the test. I'm not allowed to intervene in that as their teacher, but my evaluation is based on how they do. So if my students decide to do, I can do about that. Not a thing that I can do about that. What's happening is that very good teachers are being driven out of the profession by this testing and accountability movement. So while it makes for good politics, and it's nice for politicians to say, by golly, we're going to hold our teachers accountable for this and that and the other, they're not holding teachers accountable. They're holding teachers hostage, and the teachers can't do anything about it. They're not even allowed to talk about it. And they've been told by the Secretary of Education that if they opt out, they're risking their certification as teachers. So their hands are really tied. And you talk about those who are being punished by these tests. The students are suffering, but nobody's suffering like teachers.
Right. And it's already a profession that's underfunded, undermanned. And yet we're putting ever increasing pressure on them. You know, I have a lot of teachers that I work with, you know, and, you know, it breaks my heart when I hear critics of education talk about, well, they only work 10 months a year. They only work 7.5 hours a day. You know, every teacher that I talk to works every evening. They're at school before 7 o'clock in the morning. They're at school until 4 or 5 o'clock in the evening. They take work home. They're working in the at night, and they say, if I don't do that, I can't be. I'm not as well prepared the next day to give my students the things that they need to have. And it's heartbreaking because they're under a microscope. That's, you know, is it really necessary to be under the microscope?
Teachers know how to teach.
They know how to test. And when I want to know how my child is doing in school, I will talk to my child's teacher because nobody knows better than the teacher how my child is doing. And yet their opinion isn't factored into any of these tests that are into the testing movement.
Right.
It has nothing to do with the teacher, except that they get punished if their students
underperform. As you said a moment ago, they can't intervene to help encourage the student to perform at a level that they need to perform at.
Let me give you another example. There was a news program on this morning about Syrian refugees, and some have been fortunate enough to make it to the United States. Okay. Well, what if you just arrived from Syria last week, and your daughter's in the ninth grade? She doesn't know English, but she has to take algebra. Do you know that she has to take the end of course exam, even though she can't read it? That student who can't read English has to take the end of course exam. She may know algebra if it's taught in Arabic. She just doesn't know it if it's in English. She will be judged, and her teacher will be judged on her score on that test.
Yeah,
that's
how ridiculous this has become. Yeah, I've talked to a lot of teachers who say, you know, that students, even ESOL students, English as a second language students, intellectually limited students, learning disabled students, they all
impaired,
take
right.
the same test and evaluated the same way. So, you know, it's a shame. It's again, yeah. I was dancing
criminal.
Around that again.
Criminal. I'll go right after. We said it was going to be a full frontal assault. It really is criminal what we're doing to students and teachers with the way tests are run today. And it's sad that policymakers, again, while it sounds good politically and it sounds like you're a tough legislator, we're going to hold everybody to a standard, that sounds great. But what you're doing is you're forcing really good teachers out of the profession. By using tests that aren't reliable, that aren't valid. Imagine you go to the doctor and you have some pain, and the doctor says, well, we're going to give you this test. We don't know what it does, but we're going to give you this test. You wouldn't tolerate that for a minute, but that's what we're doing to 50 million school children. We're saying we're going to give these tests that aren't very good. We know they don't work very well. We know that they mainly punish kids. But we're going to do it anyway. And it's that attitude, when you don't listen to the professionals, when you don't listen to the teachers, when you don't listen to the people on the front lines, and you have these policies that don't make sense, you're inviting civil disobedience. And that's what the opt-out movement is. You've left parents, including this parent, with no choice but to resort to civil disobedience. We're breaking the law if we don't have if we say our children aren't going to take the test. That's the only choice you can give us.
Again, the long-term consequences really fall to the student, because you know when we tie these high-stakes testing to graduation, to your ability to get a standard diploma. What happened?
What college you go to? What college you get
accepted
to?
It greatly limits what the student can do, what options the student has. And again, kind of going back to what we were saying at the beginning, it doesn't afford the students the opportunity. We're not creating an opportunity for the students to gain pre-employment skills. We're not making them career ready. And so instead, what we're doing is we're punishing. We're creating an environment where, you know, they're less likely to be successful, and we're limiting their options when they graduate, if they graduate.
Right. We've spent a lot of time talking about Algebra 1, and here's another example. So a student takes the Algebra 1 end of course exam, fails it or does poorly on it, gets a low grade. Is there any mechanism in place to teach that student Algebra 1 and get them through the math? No, they just don't take Algebra 2. And so there are no policies to change in it, to educate the child, which is what schools are supposed to be doing. So fine, we have a testing program that says your child is not proficient in Algebra 1. We're not going to do anything about that. we're simply going to put her in different math classes, but we're not going to do anything about her inability to do Algebra 1. That's where I have the problem. You want to have tests that tell me something? Fine. But then what are you going to do with the results of saying you lose? The results of saying you lose. You know, you don't make it. You didn't make the cut. So
yeah,
your career's over.
Miss Cassie reminded me that when we had our open house this past week, she was talking to another teacher that who happened to stop by, who said that after this year she's done.
She's done, and she is a superb teacher. She can't do it anymore. We're putting public school teachers. Let me tell you something else. We're getting short of time. I think we have a couple of minutes, but if you go to districts that are well funded, for example, in Florida, if you go to Palm Beach County, very little turnover in their teachers. Okay, the students are motivated, their parents are supportive, and it's very difficult to get a cheap teaching job in Palm Beach County. Students are doing well; they're highly motivated. There's plenty of money because of the tax base. There's plenty of money. The teachers don't have to spend their own money on supplies and materials, so those teachers don't leave. But when you get into these poor districts, you have very high teacher turnover. Well, guess which students are going to do better? The students whose teachers are there for 20 or 30 years, or the schools where the teachers turn over every year? Or every year or two, or they can't even fill the positions that they have. Clark County in Nevada needs 900 teachers. They have 900 teacher openings in Clark County, Nevada, Las Vegas. And same thing in Los Angeles. Hundreds of vacancies that they just can't fill. Guess what kind of schools they're in? They're not in the wealthy districts. And that's the achievement gap that all these educational reforms, especially high-stakes testing, was designed to close the achievement gap.
Right.
And it's not closing.
Well, there's a lot more for us to talk about this. And I think that, you know, we've been talking about maybe adding an extra podcast each week so that we can talk about some of these things but still cover a lot of our mental health things that we like to talk about. And because that's, you know, again, we could talk about the mental illness in the school system for more time and longer. So, but that's going to be it for today. We'll talk more about it. We'll maybe do a midweek podcast just to kind of fill in some more stuff. Check out our website. Check us out on iTunes. Follow us on Twitter and on Facebook to get lots of information. There's information about our workshops. We just posted that on our website earlier this week. So until next time, I'm Dr. Bernie.
And I'm Dr. Richard. Thank you for listening to The Mental Breakdown. If you want more information, you can check out our website at www.pacflorida.com. The Mental Breakdown is sponsored in part by theledger.com, where you can read our weekly column in the Live section. Our podcasts are available for download on iTunes, and you can follow us on our YouTube channel and Facebook. We would love to hear from you, so feel free to send us messages either through our website or on Facebook. You can send us questions or topics you would like for us to address on future podcasts. Drs. Bernie and Richard are available for workshops, so you can contact us for more information. Thank you for listening, and until next time, stay mentally healthy.